Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest this week is Adam Davidson, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Prior to joining the magazine, he co-hosted NPR's Planet Money, which he also helped found. At The New Yorker, Davidson has been focusing on President Trump's tangled business empire, which may now be in the crosshairs of federal law enforcement. To discuss all this, as well as the investigation into the president's lawyer, Michael Cohen, whose home and office were raided last week, or 2 weeks ago maybe, as well as the Russia investigation, I thought it would be fun to talk to Davidson, who joins me now from New York City. Adam, how are you?
I'm great. Hey, Isaac.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thrilled to. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a piece several days ago, and it's called The End Stages of the Trump Presidency. And I'll just read our audience something from the piece for people who haven't read it. You mentioned the Iraq War and the financial crisis, both of which you covered. And you write, quote, "I thought of these earlier experiences this week as I began to feel a familiar clarity about what will unfold next in the Trump presidency. There are lots of details and surprises to come, but the endgame of this presidency seems as clear now as those of Iraq and the financial crisis did months before they unfolded." And then you say we are now in the end stages of the Trump presidency. What is it that's gone on in the last few weeks or months that's made you think this?
So, first of all, for a year and a half now, I'm one of several reporters who've been studying intently Donald Trump's businesses, his relationships with people around the world, not just Russia, but other people as well. And I think as a rule, this group of reporters finds it increasingly shocking just how flagrant the Trump Organization was in dealing with some of the shadiest, I mean, frankly, in cases, purely evil people who made their money in wildly illegal and corrupt ways. People have been convicted of crimes ranging and or have been under serious investigation, ranging from money laundering for Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps to, drug dealing to all sorts of financial crimes. And it's been a concern that this, I do think most Americans, including Trump's hardcore supporters, have a general sense that this is a guy who isn't going to be a stickler for the rules and is probably done some sort of technically illegal things or shady things. But I don't think the full, both lawless and also kind of pathetic and lame nature of the Trump business, I don't think that has entered the national narrative in the way I think it should. Before the FBI raided, the Department of Justice announced that they were going to be seriously investigating Michael Cohen, or had been seriously investigating Michael Cohen, it seemed at least possible that Mueller's investigation would end sort of in a draw, that he clearly would be able to show, because he already has, that there was collusion between some parts of the Trump world and some parts of the Kremlin. But I could imagine a situation where he says, well, we really couldn't nail Donald Trump himself. There's no evidence that he himself directed or participated in this, and that Trump's supporters and Fox News would declare a victory, and we'd enter a new phase of the Trump presidency, one in which, I'm sure there'll be a chaos fairly soon because the president's good at fomenting chaos, but at least for some period of time, there'd be a sort of post-crisis phase. And once we got to Michael Cohen and the raid and information that they've been monitoring, his email and presumably his phone traffic for months, that told me that there is no post-crisis phase of the Trump presidency, that we now have two investigations, and this new one, the one that involves Cohen is going to get a lot closer to the core of who Trump is. And that, much like earlier cases, like the Iraq War, like the financial crisis, I think it takes a long time for national narratives to shift and change, but they do eventually shift and change. And I think this one will shift to a very different understanding of who this Donald Trump guy is.
Right. I mean, I guess that raises the political question, or to me, in a way, the sort of disturbing political question of, if you're correct that the national narrative is going to shift in some way, which, you know, could take the form of Trump's approval rating dropping from like 40% to 28%, or, you know, a large chunk or a significant chunk of the Republican Party turning on him, the sort of chunk of the party that never viewed him that favorably, according to polls before the election, say, but sort of reluctantly voted for him, something like that. I think that that's plausible. I think the sort of tougher question is how that manifests itself politically with the financial crisis. The financial crisis happened and Republicans were kicked out of office, and that was very clear. But in terms of ending the Trump presidency, it would sort of require a political act like impeachment and removal from office. And it's hard to see, even if a national narrative shifted, exactly how we would get that, at least from the sort of politics of today.
Yeah, and it's certainly an uphill battle. And you know, if you wanted to make a smart bet, the bet would be he's not removed from office. But I have been in this situation before. You know, on the day that George W. Bush landed on the aircraft carrier with mission accomplished, support for the Iraq War and for George W. Bush was 70%. I remember I was in Iraq for most of the first year of the U.S. occupation, but I came home on a little bit of a break in June of 2003, so a few months after the invasion. And I remember finding it just bizarre how even my sort of New York kind of lefty friends just didn't believe me that the situation in Iraq was a disaster and found my warnings absurd. I mean, even in 2004, my friend Farnaz Fasihi at the Wall Street Journal got in a lot of trouble for writing a fairly factual email about how disastrous the situation in Iraq was. And so I think that, you know, the political problem is a public opinion problem. And so I think, I guess that's the prediction I'm making, is that public opinion will change enough that it will fundamentally alter the political dynamics. Now, there will, of course, be districts that are firm Trump districts, and those congresspeople or even senators are not going to be able to shift. And getting to 2/3 of the Senate, which is needed for removal from office, that's a high, high bar. And I, you know, it would take a lot. But I think that a thorough accounting of the people Trump did business with, what the business was, and especially if we do find, and, you know, I'm suspecting, but I can't say for sure, that, you know, Michael Cohen will have recordings or emails that show that the Trump Organization knew they were basically helping fairly evil people continue their crimes by putting the Trump brand on their projects so as to make them less suspicious. I think we're going to find it very hard for an awful lot of Republicans to support. That's a prediction. Predictions are hard, especially about the future, as they say. And I certainly, you know, would not say I know I'm right. Of course, I don't know that I'm right.
I would just, the one thing I would say, I want to move on to the business empire. But I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned the thing with Iraq and telling people how bad it is and people didn't believe you. One sort of interesting flip here is, I find, at least talking to a lot of people on the left, a lot of liberals, which you see online and conversations that I have with family and friends, the sense is actually that Trump is going to be impeached and that this can't last 4 years. And of course, at some point, the Republicans are going to turn on him. To me, it's a problem in the other direction of, there's no way this can keep going on and on and on, when in fact, the most likely scenario is it's going to keep going on and on and on. And so that sort of mindset among people on the left, I do think, is an interesting kind of inversion of what you were talking about earlier.
Although that was true with Iraq as well. I mean, the left, you know, was very hostile to the war. Obviously, we had big marches against it. And I don't know that it's that different. I mean, I have to think about that. But it also, I mean, I would say the left was right in the Iraq War. You know, there is a nakedness to his corruption and illegality where he's not really trying to hide it. You know, it's sort of a source of pride. So it's not that we'll reveal that he's corrupt or, you know, criminal or bends the rules, but I think the specifics are troubling. And I think the more you engage the specifics,
right,
and you step away from sort of this vague, like, you know, a bunch of snowflakes hating the guy, I think the story changes. Now, yes, I don't think we can just rest assured. Yes, don't worry, he'll definitely be impeached. The political system will get him impeached. And frankly, I'm saying all this as a reporter, not as a, you know, left-winger or whatever. But yes, I recognize that what I'm saying is bold or not bold, and just what everyone's been saying all along. I recognize that. I still think that the specifics of Trump's business practices are more troubling than people have taken in.
So let me ask you about those business practices. Let me just start this way. Do you think Donald Trump is a good businessman, as a businessman, setting aside ethics?
No, definitely not.
Why?
Well, I think, you know, in many, many ways. So first of all, I mean, one kind of general, like, just test of success. And success, by the way, is not necessarily a sign of being a good business person, because a lot of business is taking risks, et cetera. But, you know, as several people showed, I think Slate, Jordan Weissman or someone at Slate did this, he has, in sort of financial terms, either lost money or certainly barely made money over the course of his career. So if you start with control of like $200 million and of your father's money, and one alternative is you just invest that kind of safely in the stock market. And the other alternative is you do whatever business you do. He has lost compared to that sort of benchmark, at least for much of the time frame that he's been in business. So that is just a sign of, okay, he, you know, he's a rich man, but it's different to start as a rich man and end up as sort of roughly exactly as rich. That's less impressive to real business people. The other thing is, especially in the real estate industry, you want to see someone amassing wealth that over time their holdings, their empire is bigger, not smaller, and that they're able to take, maybe they're not going to be taking as wild a risk as they were when they were younger, because they've been able to amass a kind of sustainable wealth, a bundle of assets that are really worth something. And we certainly see that. There's certainly plenty of people in New York real estate, say, who over the course of Trump's career have done exactly that. He hasn't. I mean, if you know, he's this brash guy doing, you know, big loud projects in the 1970s, and he's a brash guy doing less big, less loud projects in the 2000s. And by, you know, 2010, he's basically a failed real estate guy who then starts a new career as, you know, basically a pitch man, putting his name on projects that other people are going to make, you know, have the potential to make tens of millions, and he's going to make, you know, single digit millions. So given where he comes from, given the industry he's in, given the places that he's been along that journey, you know, he's richer than I am. And, you know, I know his followers seem to see that as really relevant. But if you look at his peers, if you look at any sensible benchmark, this is not a guy who's really impressing a lot of people.
He's, well, just to ask you about that, which is that during the campaign, there were a lot of stories about Trump not being a particularly good businessman, his failed ventures, his bankruptcies, and so on. And when I would talk to Trump supporters or go to meetups or something like that, one of the things that I heard several times was essentially, how can he not be a good businessman? He's one of the most famous people on earth with a universally recognized brand, and he lives in one of the most famous buildings in the world, and everyone knows what him and his wife look like. This was all before he ran for president. And there is a sense in which he succeeded before he even ran for president, regardless of how many bankruptcies he had or, you know, how he's compared to other real estate developers. He made himself into a universally recognized brand. And it seems to me that even most of us who were given $200 million of our father's money could not do that. And so I'm wondering what you think that is and how you think that fits or doesn't fit with what you say is his not very good business sense.
You know, over the course of Donald Trump's life, branding has become much more central to how American businesses strategize, how they measure their success, et cetera. I mean, to say the obvious thing that everyone points to, you know, Coca-Cola's sugar water that, you know, has the Coca-Cola brand on it. But even, you know, Boeing and others are very aware of the brand as a central part of their value. And we've learned a lot about how to manage brand. I mean, brands are a new thing. You know, they're sort of commonly understood to have started probably with Ivory Soap, maybe 130 years ago, 1879, I think, and developed and have developed into one of the central tools of American business. You know, I think there's been a dramatic sea change over the course of the 70s and 80s in how we manage brands, how we think about brands. And his brand is if the test is simply have people heard of it, then, you know, I guess a lot of people have heard of him. But if the test is, has he been able to monetize that brand? Has he been able to turn that into real brand value and sustaining brand value and growing brand value so that each year the brand itself is worth more? That is not the case. I mean, there are, I think, 14 Trump hotels in the world, and that's a fairly stable number. When you look at the projects that he's been doing over the last decade, you know, there was an attempt at a Trump Baku, Azerbaijan, an attempt at a Trump Mumbai, an attempt at a Trump Uruguay. We don't have, it's nothing like the incredible expansion of Four Seasons or Ritz-Carlton, where you have hotels in London and Paris and, all the best cities in the world. And also you have partnerships with the leading business people. And you have brands that each year are appreciating in value. Trump is sort of selling his name for these, you know, 1 million here, 5 million there kind of contracts to pretty much anyone who will reach out and can pay the money. So it's, from a branding standpoint, it's a pretty pathetic business. And we saw that in the kind of just throwing his name on anything, even no matter how peripheral or lousy the product is. So, I mean, I think one of the many things we can learn from Trump support is that I think a lot of people conflate fame with success and sort of trappings of wealth with actual wealth. You don't have to go to, you know, say Warren Buffett or Jeff Bezos to find more successful business people. I'd say even if you just look at his immediate peers, he's just a non-entity who makes a lot of noise.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Do you have a sense from looking at his business dealings the last year or so how his kids are doing running the business and if they do it any differently than he does?
It seems to be a pretty much moribund business. I mean, it's they have some commercial properties that they're able to that generate some income, and they have the ongoing hotel deals where they own a few hotels and then they manage hotels for other people. So they do have some income coming in. They have less in those businesses because, you know, famously, several properties like Trump Soho, Trump Panama have removed their name and removed them from any involvement. And all of his properties, as I understand it, are suffering from very low occupancy, including the Trump DC. His golf courses have never really made much money. And, you know, it's famously a really tough, tough business. So their goal before he became president, their big goal for the year, or for the sort of 2017, 2018, was to launch this new 3- and 4-star kind of, you know, roadside motel business. The American idea is the 3-star and American Sign is the 4-star. And that's just been a total disaster. I mean, they, you know, were promising hundreds and hundreds of properties, and they have 3 in Cleveland, Mississippi area in the Delta, with one company that they've only signed one company, and it doesn't seem like they're really actively selling it. So I think it's a pretty rough time for the family business right now. Now it seems like they have enough kind of revenue coming in that I don't think that it's an existential crisis that they might go bankrupt any day, but they're certainly not expanding in any impressive way.
So let me ask you then to turn to Michael Cohen and his role in this Trump business empire. I mean, I think most people think of Michael Cohen essentially as Trump's fixer, who pays off women who Trump has slept with, or, you know, God knows what. And, you know, that's kind of the role he plays. Do you have a sense of the larger role Michael Cohen may play in Trump business dealings, or what he means to the Trump empire?
Yeah, I mean, his main job was not as a lawyer of any kind. His main job was as a dealmaker, as a guy who would travel the country and the world looking for possible projects, looking for partners who might want to get the Trump name on their hotel, or buildings that, you know, office buildings that might want to have a Trump name on them. And within the Trump organization, that was a very clearly distinct role, the deal maker versus the lawyer role. And that was his primary role. And so the reason I think he's so significant is there's this period of very rapid expansion into these overseas licensing deals. It's sort of remarkable, like between 2006 and then really speeding up 2010, 11, 12 into 2016, they're just going all over the world. And by they, I mean, 3 people, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Michael Cohen. And they are signing deals with really, you know, sort of famously corrupt people in famously corrupt parts of the world, doing, you know, virtually no due diligence that we can tell or that they can claim, and taking some enormous legal risks, all the while saying, well, we didn't know they were bad, we didn't know the details, et cetera, et cetera. So he will have the email traffic that will tell us what exactly is happening, you know, what exactly did they know about these partners? How aware were they of these partners' illegality? Or how careful were they to not know? Because in American law, being deliberately, it's called willful blindness. So if I do business with you and, you know, you constantly show up with all the telltale signs of a notorious criminal, and I never ask you, and I ask everyone not to tell me, that's deliberate ignorance. That's willful blindness. And that's essentially legally the same as actually knowing. So I think that we will get a much richer sense of what the Trump organization knew, what about the illegality of their partners, and we'll know to what extent did the Trump organization understand that it was essentially playing a role in a criminal operation. That, you know, at least what seems to be the case is that the Trump organization was, the role it played, at least in a lot of these deals, was that there was someone doing something shady, often laundering money through real estate, which is very common. And by putting the Trump name, it gave them a little bit of cover that, you know, Zia Mammadov, who's, you know, one of the most corrupt people in Azerbaijan, one of the most corrupt countries on earth. If it's a Zia Mammadov project, maybe it gets a lot of scrutiny when he starts sending money around the world for tile or for architecture services or whatever it might be. But if it's a Trump property, maybe that gives it a little bit of cover, makes it seem like it's more of a legitimate project.
We know the role Michael Cohen played in possibly trying to get a Trump Tower built in Moscow several years ago. And I'm wondering, you've been looking at the Russia story and at the Trump business story, and earlier you referred to kind of journalists who are on the beat of the Trump business story. To what degree do you think that these are going to eventually, you've been talking about this kind of expanding consciousness we're going to have about where this is all going. To what degree eventually do you think the Trump business story and the Russia story are going to meld and become the same story?
Well, I think the bigger story is the Trump business story, and the Russia stuff is a subset of that. You know, look, Donald Trump is somebody who's been trying to, you know, score big through business, you know, since the 1970s or 1960s. He's a guy who's been trying to make it politically for a couple of years. So I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument that this really was not a presidential run. This was an effort to burnish his brand, to sell more properties around the world, and specifically to get a Trump Tower Moscow. I think that was a major, major goal for Donald Trump for reasons that still don't quite make a lot of sense. And so I think we are going to find that the Trump Russia story and the Trump business story really are one and the same, although the Trump business story is bigger because it involves problematic oligarchs in Indonesia, in Uruguay, in many, many India, crucially, in many parts of the world that have nothing to do with Russia. And I think that's the key lesson of this Cohen investigation, that we're not stopping with Russia. We're going to keep, you know, the Justice Department, I strongly believe, is going to have to keep looking, keep studying, keep learning about this global operation.
Let me ask you, though, you said that you thought it was weird that he was so interested in Trump Tower Moscow. Why was that weird, or why is that not clear why he would want that?
I mean, I can understand why he would want it. Why he seemed obsessed with it is a little confusing. I mean, there's been some good reporting that his deal in Georgia that Michael Cohen managed was part of an attempt to create what they were calling a ring of Trump properties around Moscow. So Michael Cohen, you know, brought the Georgia deal, but sort of promised Donald Trump that would be the first of many in the former Soviet Union. Michael Cohen went to Kazakhstan to try and foster interest in a Trump Tower Kazakhstan, and you know he was exploring things with Ukraine and other parts of the former Soviet Union. So it's, I mean, I can understand why he might want it. I don't understand why it's such an obsession compared to, say, I don't know, you know, China or India. I mean, he does also have a lot of business in India. And I mean, frankly, he's been much, much more successful in India than in Russia by far. So why he just remained obsessed with, like, why can't I get Russia? Why can't I get Russia? That, you know, in my mind, I'd double down on India if I'm going to do this kind of business, or double down on the Arab Gulf or something like that.
You know, when the Paul Manafort charges broke and it became clear how much illegal activity he was engaged in separately from his work on the Trump campaign, it was pretty striking that a guy like this could go around and commit this many crimes, this many financial crimes overseas, and still kind of be a lobbyist and work in Washington. And, you know, you've been writing about the Trump business empire and the way they interact overseas and the ethical lapses that have gone on there. Have you been sort of shocked as we've sort of lifted up the rock of white collar crime to see how much is underneath it? That's a bad metaphor, but I think you get the gist of what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, it's been really upsetting, really upsetting. I think one of the key lessons of all of this is just how little we prosecute white collar crime in general, and particularly international white collar crime. You know, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is the law that outlaws Americans bribing foreign officials. And there's a couple dozen cases a year. Most of those are self-reports, meaning, you know, some big American company says, oh, one of our low-down affiliates did this bad thing. We're turning that person in so that we don't have any corporate responsibility and we'll pay a fine. Money laundering is very rarely, you know, the greatest analysis of money laundering is that it's something like 10% of the economy. I mean, it's widely understood to be a central pillar of the real estate business in New York and LA and Miami. And it's very rare for money laundering to be prosecuted. Even terror financing, even sanctions violations, we do remarkably little. And that is very upsetting. I think that it is a reminder of our two-tiered legal system. I mean, almost by definition, people doing large financial crime are people with large amounts of money. And they are able to operate with some degree of impunity. Now, I will say, even in that, Trump is an outlier. That the Trump Organization took risks, did work with partners that very few Americans would ever consider working with. And so I don't want to give the impression that he's just run of the mill. He's just like everybody else, because that's something I hear a lot. And that always drives me crazy. It makes me, you know, he's not, he's, you know, and that's not because necessarily all business people are moral. It's because they're, you know, business people are supposed to be good at balancing risk and return. And it's a bad risk to, you know, take the Mammadovs that he did this deal in Azerbaijan with. As far as we can tell, Trump made $5 million or so from that deal. If he had done his due diligence, and if he had learned, as he would have, that they were likely to be money laundering partners of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, he faced a life-changing amount of fines and potential criminal liability. And, you know, if you're a billionaire, as he claims, then you shouldn't do that for $5 million. It's an absurd risk to take. It makes no sense at all. And we see him taking such risks again and again and again. So he really is an outlier. He's not like everybody, but the norm is pretty, you know, I think when this is all over, I'll quit journalism and just go into international money laundering. It seems like, yeah, it pays better.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't even get paid for coming on this podcast. Adam, thank you so much. When Trump is in his second term, gliding along with 70% approval, we'll have you on and ask what went wrong. But in the meantime—
Sounds great. Well, I said it's the end stage of his presidency. I didn't tell you that the end stage is 7 years long.
Yeah. No, it's a long end stage. Dog years. Yeah. Adam Davidson, you can read his work at newyorker.com or subscribe to The New Yorker in print, which is a worthwhile thing to do. And Adam, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Isaac. That was really fun.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Max Jacobs. Thanks to Topher Ruth at Northgate Studios in Berkeley. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. We got a ton of feedback about our interview with Barbara Ehrenreich via email and Twitter. A lot of people seemed to like it. A lot of people didn't seem to like it. So keep the feedback coming, and keep the feedback coming on the pronunciation of names that I apparently do very poorly. We got a lot of criticism on that front. So thank you again for listening.